Going Linux, Episode 14, Listener Feedback. Welcome to the Going Linux Podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy. Going Linux is a podcast for computer users who just want to use Linux to get things done. The Going Linux Podcast will provide you with practical, day-to-day advice on how to use the Linux operating system. If you're new to Linux, moving to Linux, or even if you're just thinking about going Linux, this podcast is for you. Our goal is to help make the Linux experience easy for you. As usual, in the user experience episodes, we cover a topic over a two-month period. During the first month, we cover general topics of interest to switchers to Linux, just getting comfortable with their new operating system. In month two, we cover the same topic from a more advanced perspective for users of Linux trying to build their confidence and competence with Linux. Between the user experience episodes, we have listener feedback episodes like this one, where we answer listener questions and provide additional information on using Linux. Our email address for comments, questions, and suggestions is goinglinux@gmail.com, and our website is goinglinux.com for show notes, articles, information, and detailed instructions with screenshots. Today's episode, listener feedback. In this episode, we have two changes to the format of the podcast that I hope will provide you, the listeners, with some added interest, added value, and something new. The first change will become apparent in a minute, but the second is that the Going Linux podcast will be conducting interviews periodically with people of interest to users of Linux and switchers to Linux. In this episode, I'll be interviewing J. Daniel Sawyer, a Linux user who has authored several articles for a Linux journal and who has some other surprises for you as well. Now, on to our listener feedback and emails. Our first email is from Tom.
Hi, Larry. I'm a Linux noob who started with Dapper, maybe a year ago. All told, it's been a really positive experience. I've listened to your show up until episode 11, and you've given me some great ideas. Thanks. Before I dive into number 12, I'd like to offer some advice and perhaps service. Since you lost your partner, the show is lacking just a bit. Listening to two people keeps my interest more than just one. My mind doesn't drift as much, and I find myself backing up less. Maybe that's just me. Now, the possible service. How about making it the Linux Guru and the Linux Noob? I won't talk much, just ask questions now and then. Let me know what you think. Thanks again. Best, Tom.
At this point in the podcast, I normally read my response. Here's where you get to experience the first change to our format. Today, we take Tom up on his offer and invite him to be on Going Linux as a guest host for the podcast. It's my pleasure to introduce Tom Chaudoir. Tom, welcome to the Going Linux podcast.
Thanks, Larry. I'm really happy to be on board. I've gotten the feeling that Linux is a community, not just an operating system, and this gives me a chance to give something back.
Okay, Tom, so now that you're a guest host, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience with Linux?
Well, I'll start with my pre-Linux experience. I'm a recovering Windows user. I got tired of all the malware, the blue screen of death, and the general struggle to keep the machine running. But I sat on the fence for quite a long time before I found out that I could keep Windows and have Ubuntu Linux on my machine at the same time and try it out. Well, that worked great. At first, I only booted Ubuntu now and then and poked around and got familiar with it. And then after a couple of months, I was doing almost everything with it. And now, I really can't remember the last time I booted Windows, and I don't know how I ever lived without Ubuntu. So, I guess you can say I'm a Linux user all the way.
Yeah, I know how you feel. I have to use Windows at work, and I use Linux almost exclusively at home. I'm much happier using the Linux operating system. So, Tom, as your first duty as guest co-host, why don't you read our next email?
Okay, Larry, I'd love to. Our next email is from Curtis, and Curtis says, "Hello, I just stumbled across your podcast tonight as a result of listening to The Lip. Your idea of starting at the beginning for new users is great. I look forward to many more episodes. Curtis."
Here's my response to Curtis by email. Thanks for the email, and thanks for listening to the Going Linux podcast. I get a number of referrals from The Lip, and appreciate that podcast as well. If you've listened to the early episodes of the Going Linux podcast, you'll know that I have a connection to The Lip by way of its original host and my former co-host, Serge Ray. Serge and I agreed that we should keep Going Linux non-geeky and straightforward so that it's easy for the newcomers to Linux to understand what's going on. I think I've stayed true to that concept, and after more than half a year of the show, I'm still having a lot of fun covering the topics, as you've said, from the beginning. What's your perspective on this, Tom?
That's what I really like about the show. It helps new Linux users, and boy, there are a lot of us out here. And people just need to find out Linux isn't scary. It's just a little different, and it's better, and it's free, as in free beer.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%, Tom. Let's go on to our next email.
Okay, here's an email from Dan Sawyer. I recognize that name. Dan writes, "Hey guys, I just ran across your promo on the Seventh Son podcast and thought I'd drop you a line. My name is Dan Sawyer. I run a media studio on Linux and write articles for Linux Journal about the topic, and I'm attempting to build some name recognition and such in anticipation of launching a fiction podcast later this year. If ever you have a use for a guest expert who's well-versed in video production, visual effects, DVD mastering, and audio production in Linux, drop me a line. I'd be happy to come on. Great show you guys have going on there. Keep up the great Linux evangelism. Dan Sawyer."
I did have a chance to interview Dan, and here's the interview I did with him late last month. Dan Sawyer is a Linux user who runs a media studio using Linux. He's well-versed in video production, visual effects, DVD mastering, and audio production. He's also written several articles for Linux Journal. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast, Dan.
Greetings. Good to be here.
It's good to have you. First of all, I'd like to ask you, how did you find out about the Going Linux podcast?
Well, I heard your promo on the end of one of the Seventh Son podcasts.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I've gotten quite hooked on both Hutchins and Sigler, so.
Me too. I don't miss an episode. I'm waiting for the latest episode of The Rookie to come out.
The Rookie's done. It's Nocturnal's going to be the next one.
Oh, that's right, too.
Yeah. When he was over here for my podcast, he said he's probably not going to be done with it till like November. But he's doing short fiction in the meantime.
Yeah, I've been listening to that. It's been very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned that you are preparing to launch a fiction podcast of your own. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. I've been a fiction writer as a hobby for years and years, and it's one of those things I've always wanted to get serious about, but never quite had the motivation. But after talking to Sigler several times this year, I decided to put my money where my desires were, so to speak. So I'm starting off with a podcast of short fiction that's collectively entitled Sculpting God.
Uh-huh.
It's fantasy, horror, science fiction, and romance. They're all kind of mixed in a muddle together. I'm that kind of twisted guy. And then once the novel that I'm finishing up the polished draft on is done, we'll move from Sculpting God into the novel, which is Predestination and Other Games of Chance. It's
okay.
A science fiction espionage thriller. You can keep up with the latest on all that at jdsawyer.net.
Okay, jdsawyer.net. I'll put that link in our show notes for our listeners.
Now, please excuse the lame site theme right now. It's still being designed.
Yeah, that's all right. You're just getting started, and we're looking forward to hearing more from you in the future and reading more from you in the future when we get something in publication form.
Yeah, unfortunately, all that you're going to get in that form for a little while yet is Linux Journal, but I do have three articles now slated to come out in the next several issues. So one of them is a review of KDN Live. Another one is a how-to and review of Blender's compositing engine. And the third one is how to convert your laptop into a multi-track audio recorder for use on locations.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. I've read a couple of the articles on Linux Journal that you've already published, and your writing is very clear. It's easy to follow, and I think anybody interested in video production would get a lot out of it.
Well, thank you very much.
While we're on that topic, since you're the kind of guy who seems to know an awful lot about video, would you be willing to take one of our listener questions on the topic?
Certainly.
Okay. Let me take a minute to read the email, and then I'll turn you loose on it, okay?
All right.
The email is from Rick, and he writes, I'm a newbie to Linux. I'm also a newbie to video production. For the past year, I've been using a commercial product that is expensive. It also only works in Windows. I want to be able to do video production in Linux. I want to know what tools are available to do this. Well, that's question one. He goes on.
Okay.
Also, I'm planning on the purchase of a new video camera, and I want to know which one to pick based on its compatibility with Linux. Also, I'm interested in knowing which codecs are free and open source. And since our audience on the Going Linux podcast are typically newbies to Linux and maybe newbies to editing video as well, perhaps I can ask you to define codecs as well. So he finishes up by saying thanks in advance and signs it High-Tech Waiter, which is kind of an interesting thing in itself.
It's a great handle. I'll take them in reverse order because the complexity increases as we go backwards.
There you go.
Codec is short for compressor decompressor. It takes raw video, or ideally raw video, and shrinks it down by throwing away data that the eye does not see. MPEG compression works by recording only some frames in the frame series, throwing out all the stuff in the middle, and introducing a mathematical algorithm that essentially morphs one keyframe into the next. All your DVDs are encoded with a version of MPEG called MPEG-2. DivX and XVID are both versions of MPEG-4, as is WMV-9, which is going to be the basis for the HD DVD format.
Okay, so most of the TLAs, three-letter acronyms that you just threw out, are file formats like
right,
WMA
all file formats,
and
yeah.
so on. Yeah, okay, video file.
Right, those file formats describe the codecs they're compressed with. You can encapsulate those codecs with QuickTime or with AVIs or with any number of things.
Those are little programs that work within the video program that you're using to encode or make the file you're working with into a video.
Not quite. They're subroutines rather than full programs.
Okay.
Let's say you have a zip file, right?
Uh-huh.
You can have a zip file stuffed inside a tar, which would be a tar.gz or a tar.bz2, depending on which compression algorithm you use.
Right.
The codec is the same kind of compression algorithm that a zip compression is. It just works on video with video's unique properties instead of on data generally.
Okay.
Some codecs are lossy, which means that once you run them, you've actually lost data. You can never get it back.
Okay.
Those are usually used for delivery of content rather than as an intermediate format when you're creating content. Because if you compress something and then you recompress it with a lossy codec, each time it's throwing more data away, your picture quality degrades, it gets less sharp, you know, you get more blocks. Yeah, we've all seen really blocky video on the web. That's
right.
Because someone went from a lossy format to a lossy format to a lossy format until it finally got to you and most of the picture's just not there anymore.
It's just degraded to the point where it's blocks.
Right. Your production formats, they vary in the kind of things that you'll use. Sometimes, like the new HDV format uses a very high-quality MPEG-2 stream. Old mini-DV cameras use a DV format compression. These are both still lossy codecs, but they're far less lossy than delivery codecs. Mm-hmm. And once you pull them in, depending on what your production pipeline flow looks like and how many times you actually have to play with the footage in your special effects program or whatnot, you may want to convert to a lossless format, which takes up a lot more space on your hard drive, but doesn't degrade as it goes through every step of the production. I cover this a little bit in the article I wrote for Linux Journal called The Linux Video Production Pipeline, which was in the January 06 issue.
Okay, and we'll have links to the journal and to some of your articles as well on the show notes for our listeners.
As far as what codecs are free and open source, well, it depends on what stage of the production process you're talking about. If you're talking about acquisition and production codecs, you've got essentially DROC, Mini-DV, PuffYUV, and a few of the other uncompressed formats that FFmpeg supports, and that's it. You know, uncompressed QuickTime, that kind of thing. That's pretty much it for free and open source, which means...
Okay. When you're using the term free, you're talking about no charge, or you're talking about free being free as in speech?
Well, I'm talking about no charge. In this, in this instance, free and open source. Open source implies free as in speech, so I'm taking free to imply free as in beer.
Okay, and I think, you know, reading Rick's question again, he does say free and open source, so let's deal with it from that perspective.
Yeah, so that's those are the only ones you'll get that are free and open source. You'll have quite a few formats that are open source but not free, ironically. These are the reverse engineered patent encumbered formats, like the MPEG formats. Technically, though very few people do it, if you are encoding, say, MPEG-2 to master a DVD, technically you're supposed to send a nickel off to the DVD consortium every time you do that.
Literally a nickel?
That's what it was last time I checked.
Okay.
Or you can buy, like, a mass license if you're doing a lot of duplication. But technically, that's supposed to happen. There's an aggregate licensing organization, I forget who they are now, that is seeking to protect Linux users from that by setting up kind of an aggregate fee structure that deals with all that stuff. If you are not duplicating on a massive scale and selling things, you're not going to get noticed. You're technically infringing a patent.
Right.
When you get down to the level of delivery codecs, there are a few more options for free and open source.
Okay.
The chief among them is DivX. XVID. Which forked off of DivX back when it was still an open source codec.
Right.
XVID is a free and open source codec, and it also is one of the more popular web codecs. Another one is AUG-Theora, which is based on Sorenson Video 3, which is also what YouTube used exclusively right up until recently. Flash 8 was based on AUG-Theora. Mm-hmm. Flash 8 is completely free and open source. Flash 9 isn't yet. But all the sites that play, anyone that can play Flash 9 can play Flash 8. It's just the quality's a little lower.
Right.
Let's see what else. DROC, which was developed by the BBC to handle both their end content delivery and their internal lossless compression, is not quite ready yet. It's you can get the source code, you can use it, but it's still being polished, and I wouldn't recommend using it in a I rely on it sort of fashion yet. But it is both free and open source, and it's really, really impressive. It's very versatile. It has lossless modes, it has lossy modes, and once BBC introduces it as their primary streaming format, it's going to be a very useful codec to have in your package of tricks.
Have they given any sort of idea as to when that might be?
Well, they have released the first encoding boxes as of about 3 or 4 months ago. But I believe it's going to be another year or so before they actually begin delivering content with it.
Okay. And it sounds like it's available for use now. It's just, as you said, it's something not necessarily something that you should be relying on.
Right. They consider it alpha software still.
Okay.
So not even in the beta stage yet.
Right. Well, like most things in Linux land, a functional alpha works pretty much about as well as a decent beta in commercial land. So,
right.
Yeah, the original idea with beta software is that it's fully functional, but you're trying to debug it, make sure you vet out all the problems before you release it into the wild. And that's the way it works in Linux land. In Windows land, the bar has lowered a bit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what you have in Windows land is you have your alpha software is called your beta software.
Yeah.
Alpha means it's functional and can be used, but it doesn't have all the features it will eventually have, and it's not stable.
Right.
But that's what betas in Windows land look like. Mm-hmm. And in Windows land, when you get to 1.0, that's what most software engineers would call beta software. It's fully functional, but it's got a lot of bugs.
Yep.
And there's an old joke when I used to work as a computer tech that when it came from Microsoft, essentially version 3.0 was everyone else's 1.0. And that rule, unfortunately, has held firm ever since.
Oh, dear.
that was back in the days of Windows for Workgroups.
That's a while ago.
Yeah.
Well, back to Rick's email. He mm-hmm. was asking about what video camera you would recommend. Yeah.
It depends entirely on what video format you're intending to shoot in. If you are satisfied to stay with standard definition video, pretty much any FireWire-based camera will do you good. It'll work off libDV. You can use it in every single editor available on the planet, or at least on the platform. And you're going to have no problems. It's been around so long, it's been thoroughly commoditized. I haven't heard of a DV camera not working with Linux in at least 2-3 years.
Mm-hmm.
If you are going for the new HDV cameras, it's a crapshoot right now. The format has finally been established, and the cameras are excellent. At the moment, the only ones I know of for sure that are working reliably are the Canon cameras, and you do have to grab HDV with DVGrab right now, which is a command line only utility.
Uh-huh. Okay.
There is no graphical capture program for HDV as of yet. The rumor has it that KDN Live is working on it.
Ah, okay. So the HDV cameras, which I'm assuming are the more expensive pro or prosumer type cameras.
There are HDV cameras now in the $500 or $600 price range in a Handycam format.
Oh, that's not bad. Okay, yeah. So that might indeed be something that somebody new to video might pick up if they're interested in high definition or higher definition video. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the FireWire cameras, and I know FireWire as an interface between the camera and the computer is going to be faster and more reliable than something like USB. But what about USB cameras for somebody just getting started, maybe toying around with video and not really quite committed to it yet?
I honestly haven't used USB cameras, so I'm not really qualified to speak on it. The place to go for that information is to bump onto the Kino users list. Dan Dennity and the crowd over there maintains DVGrab, and they know all about what interfaces are supported and how extensively.
Okay, and for our listeners who haven't heard of Kino before, how do you spell it?
K-I-N-O. It's German for movie.
Very good. Okay. All right, so I think there was another part to Rick's question here.
Unfortunately, he's not specific about what part of the production pipeline he's talking about. He may be talking about editing. I think he probably is, but he could also just as well be talking about compositing. Or he could be using something like Vegas, which kind of straddles the two. I wish he had said what he worked with, because then I could tell him better what'll match. On Linux, when you're going to edit, if you're going to edit DV, you have Kino as a basic option, and it's fabulous. It's like iMovie. It's a little less sophisticated, and it's absolutely rock solid. And I have edited long-form plays and features on Kino just because the workflow is so nice.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what I'll do is I'll do my rough cut in Kino and then export it to a multi-track and pull the cut list into a multi-track editor and do my polish work there.
Okay. So Kino is what you would recommend for editing.
Right. Well, not quite.
Okay.
Kino is DV only. It does not support HDV. It doesn't support... It will import anything that FFmpeg can read, but it will import it by converting it to DV, which is a lossy codec. So that's a trade-off that you got to weigh in terms of image quality.
Okay.
And it is only a single-track interface. It's a very, very useful thing to have in your pipeline, particularly if you're working with DV. I would not rely on it for everything. It wasn't designed to do everything.
Right.
In fact, it's one of the things it's best at, ironically, is mastering and compressing DVDs.
Okay. And by single track, you're talking about a single video stream from a single camera. Multi-track being, if you were doing a three-camera shoot, like a professional movie would be done, or a TV.
Well, that's certainly one way that you would employ multi-track. Another way is if you are even if you're just shooting with one camera and you want to be able to do things like crossfades. I mean, a single track can do crossfades, but it does them differently. You want to do crossfades, overlays, if you want to layer, particularly if you want to layer different tracks of audio, like you want your dialogue track and your soundtrack and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Each element that you bring in requires a separate track on the timeline in order for it to be convenient to work with. Kino can do a lot of this stuff by faking it, but it's very inconvenient to do that way. For multi-tracks in Linux, you have essentially three options at the moment. Four if you're in Europe.
Okay.
The reason it's four if you're in Europe is that Open Movie Editor is PAL only at this point.
Which is the European format.
Which is is the European television format. It's 25 frames per second. American is NTSC, which is 29.97 frames per second, which causes its own problems. And thankfully, with high def, we're moving to ATSC, which is true 30 frames per second and much easier to deal with.
Does that mean that as we go to that format, that we become a little more compatible with the European format?
It's going to make the conversion of one to another easier.
And so there'll still be different formats, but they'll be easier to convert.
Yes, and it's also going to make it a lot easier on people who write video software, because 29.97 frames per second requires a lot of funny math to keep the audio and video in sync.
Ah.
The Open Movie Editor is great. It's still fairly basic, but it works very wonderfully if you're working with PAL video. If you are working with NTSC video, meaning if you're in America, you don't have that option. You need to use either Blender, which has a couple little caveats as a video editor, which I'll get to in a minute. KDN Live, which is my current favorite in the field. It's still under heavy development, and not all the features work, but it doesn't crash very often. In fact, the latest version doesn't crash at all, and it reads and writes everything, so you don't have to worry about file format stuff. It sits on top of FFmpeg, and you don't have to convert things in order to get them in.
Now that sounds like a good choice.
And the last version, the last one is Cinelera, which totes itself as a really high-end editing and finishing system, and it's got a lot of very nice features, which would be wonderful if the thing actually worked, which it doesn't. I make it my business to try to make it work every 6 months to every year, because if it ever did work, it would be very useful to me. I would almost be able to get rid of my one remaining Windows machine with an After Effects install on it.
Okay.
However, it doesn't work. And when it does work, it is so bloody resource hungry.
Okay, so it's obviously still under development.
Well, actually, no. It's been around and considered finished for years.
Oh.
There's a lot of weird politics behind its development history. The primary developer is very smart, very creative, and very antisocial. So he has the "if it runs on my machine, it's done" philosophy. So there is a community fork, a group of people that he absolutely hates because they're screwing with his baby, who are trying to get it into production shape for everyone else. But even when it's in that kind of production shape, there are a lot of things about it that are just going to blow a new user completely away. It's a very unusual interface. It accepts an extremely limited range of file formats. It's something that when it's ready, it will be very useful for expert video production people, expert users, or very brave people. But
early adopters, yeah.
Right. But other than that, it's going to stay out on the fringes, I'm afraid.
And certainly sounds like it's not for the newbie, which Rick had said he is. So
yeah, Blender is a 3D production suite that has over the years started to gear itself up for becoming a true finishing system. It does have a video editor in it. It's a very nice video editor. It doesn't support 29.97 frames per second, but it does support 30. Okay. So the practical upshot of that is that you do have to manually retime the video. It's not a big deal. You right-click and you hit stretch and you match the length up with the audio when you import it, but it's a bit of a pain.
Right.
However, the rest of Blender makes it an attractive thing to use depending on what your project goal is, because you have right there available 3D, you've got a compositor, which is what After Effects and Shake and Nuke and all them do. Mm-hmm. For visual effects, you've got quite a few built-in color correction and other good useful effects for doing complex video animations and such like, and you got some basic audio tools. And once you learn Blender, it's a snap to pick up the video editor. Learning Blender on its own, that's a little bit more of a problem. There's a lot of good resources for helping you do that.
All right. Any other recommendations for Rick at this point?
Those are the only ones that are really together enough to be usable by an average guy.
Okay.
There's the commercial solutions, but they are expensive. If you want to drop money on Discrete's Smoke or Flame or Inferno, they are all available for Linux. They're all quite excellent, and they're also all about $20,000 a seat.
Okay, well, it sounds from Rick's email that he may be using something like that. He says certainly that his current software is expensive, and it sounds like he wants to get away from that. Your recommendations are probably the ones that Rick was looking for.
Cool.
One more thing, though. You mentioned editing, which I think all of our listeners will understand, but you also mentioned the term compositing.
Yes.
What is that?
Compositing is the art of bringing together more than one image source and marrying the multiple image sources together to create a single image. Say, let's take Lord of the Rings, because probably most of your listeners have seen Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
If you go to the scene where the river comes up and swallows the Black Riders as they're chasing Frodo. In that shot, you have the original footage, which is the horses, the riders, and the river. You have the enhancements that are done to the sky and the mountains to make them look more alien.
Mm-hmm.
Those are done usually in Photoshop. I believe they were done in Photoshop or GIMP or something. Or I'm sorry, Photoshop or CinePaint or something like that for that scene.
Okay.
You have little extra elements to help sell the world, which are usually done in a 3D program, like extra boulders, a little piece of statuary sitting off in the corner. And then you have the river itself, which is done in a 3D program using a particle engine, which creates the frothy and the water over the 3D models of the horses. And that's usually rendered out in several passes, one for the luminosity, one for the color, one for the opacity, because drops of water are kind of transparent. So to put that shot together, you've got something like an aggregate, if you include all the passes from the 3D program. You've got an aggregate of probably between 12 and 30 images for every that have to marry together to make every single frame of that shot. You put these together in a compositing program, which allows you to put the different image sources together to control their color balance, to control their opacity, to control how they affect each other, and to do things like masking one thing out, you know, creating holes in one image to fill it with stuff from another. It's what you do blue screening in. It's your ultimate Photoshop for moving pictures is what a compositor essentially is.
Got it. Yeah, I've heard the guys on This Week in Media podcast talking about video and rendering and those kinds of things. So I've heard the terms, and I'm not a video guy. I'm more of an audio guy. So it was completely foreign to me. So that's why I was asking the question. I'm sure a lot of the listeners to this podcast feel the same way. What is all this stuff? certainly, Dan, you are very knowledgeable about this. And before we wrap up, I just have a couple more questions that I want to ask you. Getting back to authoring for Linux Journal, for our listeners who may already be familiar with Linux and may even be fairly proficient with Linux and want to contribute by writing articles like that for Linux Journal or perhaps some other journal, how does one get started doing something like that?
Most magazines have on their website a section that says Write for Us. Sometimes it's buried under the contact page. Sometimes it's sitting off on its own. But basically, they list submission guidelines and a list of topics for articles that they are actively soliciting for particular issues. And occasionally also a list of second string article titles, which are their evergreens, stuff that they're always looking for to fill the gaps.
Mm-hmm.
You go, you find out what they're looking for, you figure out what you can write. You read some of their articles to make sure you can write in a style that's going to be compatible with what they do.
Right.
You know, writing to the right vocabulary level, the right expertise level, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then you follow their submission guidelines. Some magazines require you to write up the entire article and send it in on spec. Some magazines ask you to query it, and then they will assign it to you, and then you'll write it on spec, and then they'll decide whether to buy it once they see the whole thing. Some magazines will give you a sale off the query itself. That's usually more often when you have a publishing history, and they can look at what else you've done to make sure that they're not buying something that's going to be unintelligible.
Okay, well, thanks for all that information. That is going to be very useful to anyone interested in becoming an author for a magazine, whether that's for Linux or any other topic, I'm sure. Let's get back to something we were talking about a little bit earlier, back to podcast fiction. And I know a lot of our listeners will be familiar with the gentleman that you mentioned, Scott Sigler. I know in your August 18th episode of your own podcast, you had interviewed Scott Sigler, and it sounded to me like you were in the same room with him.
Well, two of us were in the same room. My co-host was Skyping in from Michigan.
But
Scott and I were sitting here in what passes for my recording studio, and I got him all liquored up and stuck a mic in front of him and got him to cut loose a bit.
For those who haven't listened to that interview, what's he like? I know listening to his own podcast, he comes across as an angry, foul-mouthed author. Is that part of his persona just for the podcast, or is he really like that?
He's taken one particular aspect of his personality and amped it up so that it looks like everything. He definitely is angry and foul-mouthed and has a dirty sense of humor, and he's a lot of fun because of it. He's also a very sweet guy. He's very thoughtful. He's extremely polite and just a great, great guy to hang out with. He's a lot of fun.
Well, I certainly enjoy his audiobooks, and I'm looking forward to his next one, and I'm actually looking forward to yours as well. So,
thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your podcast, where our listeners might find it, and what's it about?
We're talking about Reprobates Hour?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, the podcast is called the Polyschismatic Reprobates Hour. Poly, of course,
easy
meaning
for you to say.
Hey, it took me a good 3 hours to come up with that name.
Yeah.
I was looking for something that would stand out, and I eventually decided to come up with something no one could pronounce in order to do it. Schismatic means heretic. It's someone who actively causes trouble. Poly is many, and we are, in fact, in many ways, schismatics, my co-host and I. We're both active heretics with just about everything we come into contact with, even though she and I agree on precious little, which is part of what makes it fun.
Sure.
I'm a libertarian. She's a leftist. We get into it. It's fun. let's see. The Reprobates, of course, is a... I grew up in a very theologically saturated household and went to seminary for quite a while.
Okay.
And spent far more time than anyone really should reading the works of John Calvin. And John Calvin distinguishes those who are going to hell from those who aren't by saying that it's the difference between a reprobate and a regenerate soul. I myself no longer believe, and my co-host, who was once a Mormon, no longer believes. So reprobates seemed like a fun way to get out what we're about. Aside from which, we generally like to play it being far more disreputable than we really are, because, you know, it's entertainment and it's fun.
Absolutely. And it's certainly irreverent.
Yeah. And the hour, of course, is how long the show is. I know that's kind of anticlimactic to come to the end of that, but there you go.
That's the way it is what it is. So if our listeners are interested in finding it, where do they go?
Go to www.reprobateshour.com. We release an episode or try to about every 2 weeks, and I believe right now we've got enough episodes in the queue to last through October at least, and we're trying to load back through them to extend the season out to December. So if anyone out there would be a really fun interview, or if anyone out there has some topics they think we're completely out to lunch on and wants to start a fight, please drop an email, let us know. It's always a good thing. But yeah, we've got John McCarthy, who's the inventor of artificial intelligence. He runs a website at Stanford called the Sustainability of Human Material Progress, where he looks at the different predicted dooms for the human race, plague, global warming, nuclear destruction, and whatnot, runs the actual math on them and looks at the current data on all these things and talks about which ones he believes are actual problems, and he shows you his whole reasoning chain so you can fact check him, which ones he thinks are not actual problems but just anxiety, and in either cases what he thinks we can do to prevent things or to make things better. And in his view, at the moment, the human race isn't facing any dooms that are not preventable. So I sat down with him and we talked about all the various dooms for an hour, and quite extensively about the apocalyptic mentality, why it is that it's so attractive to think that we're doomed, rather than to look at the spectacular progress we've made over the last 150 years in just about every area and feel optimistic about the future. Something about our psyche doesn't let us do that. So we talk a lot about that too.
Wow, that sounds like a really interesting discussion. I'm going to tune in for that one.
After that one, we've got Robert Price, who is both a Lovecraft scholar and a Bible scholar. So we got two episodes with him, one talking about Lovecraft horror and the sublime and how that affects the psyche and what kind of possible value that could have. And another one talking about his latest book, The Paperback Apocalypse, which is a history of the end of the world. And then we've got Graydon Squared, who is a up-and-coming rapper from Phoenix, Arizona. And we've got Zach Moore, host of the Evolution 101 podcast, coming on to talk about how cancer works and what new therapies are in the pipeline. And we're looking for more guests.
Wow. You certainly have a lot going on. So I think for those of our listeners who are interested in any of what you just discussed, if you go to the reprobateshour.com podcast, that's where you'll find all of that stuff. Well, Dan, thanks very much for appearing on the Going Linux podcast. And before I let you go, I want to give you an opportunity to impart to our listeners any specific parting words of advice, or anything else you'd like to talk about.
Well, the task of working with media on Linux is non-trivial, but it certainly is not impossible, and it indeed isn't difficult once you get into it. The major difference you're going to run into between media tools on Linux and media tools on Windows is that in the Linux sphere, you have a far greater distance between your beginner's tools and your professional tools. Mm-hmm. In Windows, there's a solid gradient going up. You can start out with Windows Movie Maker and move up to some mid-level program like Vegas Video, and then you can move up to Premiere or whatnot for your editing.
Right.
On Linux, you've got pretty much one jump or two jumps. You can jump from the newbie to the professional, and then from the professional to the well-moneyed professional in just about every area. What this means is that you have to actually learn the theory behind what's going on your computer rather than just pushing the pretty boxes around. But if you're willing to do that, you can get out of the free software available on Linux, you can get product that is as good as or better than about 90% of what's out there, even a lot of the stuff in Hollywood.
Wow.
Other than that, you know, the same is true for audio. The same is true for images. It's a great way to do things, and you don't have to worry about licensing fees, which is my favorite part. I wouldn't actually be able to stay in business if I had that kind of overhead. The only other thing I wanted to do was pimp my other website.
Go for it.
Actually, two. I run an open source filmmaking community, which at the moment is kind of quiet, but it's quiet because everyone grew up and went and made their own media companies. There were a bunch of high school kids.
Yeah.
It's called BlenderWars.com. There's a number of tutorials on there around 3D animation and video processing in Linux with open source software on other platforms, too. And it's a good little community. There's a lot of resources there. It's definitely worth checking out. And my professional website, if you need media services of any kind, or if you want to be tutored in how to do this stuff in person, I do both of those things. I also do photography. You can see a little bit about what I've been up to at www.artisticwhispers.com. There's samples of my work and some rate sheets and everything else up there.
Okay. So one more time, both of those last two websites again?
www.blenderwars.com for the Blender Wars filmmaking community and www.artisticwhispers.com for Artistic Whispers Productions, which is my media company.
Very good. Dan, thanks very much for appearing on Going Linux. Thanks for helping out with all the advice on video, editing video, producing video, and thanks as well for spending the time with us here. Let us know when you get your podcast audiobook going. We'll put a link on our website to the book when it's ready to go.
Fabulous. And of course, naturally, it will be produced entirely with Linux.
Absolutely. Of course.
And if you get a lot of feedback that, you know, questions that you can't answer, feel free to give me a call and I'll come back on to answer them.
Well, thanks for that. I might just take you up on that if we get more video interest in the podcast. That's great.
All right.
Dan, thanks.
You're very welcome, Larry. Have a good one.
Excellent interview, Larry, and many thanks to Dan. To tell the truth, most of that was over my head, but it's a definite keeper for future reference.
Yeah, absolutely. I as I said in the interview, I'm not a video guy. I'm more of an audio guy. And I have to admit, some of that went over my head as well. But Dan certainly knows his stuff. And thanks again, Dan, for being on Going Linux. I hope to have you on in the future, especially if we have other listener feedback emails or voicemails that provide us with questions from a video perspective. Well, Tom, now that you've had a stint in the saddle as guest co-host, do you think you want to make this a permanent thing?
Well, thanks, Larry. I was hoping you'd ask. And yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and I'd love to come back. I'm looking forward to it.
So that's it for this episode of Going Linux.
In our next episode, we'll talk about installing Linux applications, advanced.
Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes at goinglinux.com for more information and detailed instructions. Our email address for email comments, questions, and suggestions is goinglinux@gmail.com. Send us an audio comment and we'll play it on the show. You can also subscribe to the podcast to get future episodes delivered automatically. Instructions are on the website. Thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.